It's always later than I think. Thanks for tuning in. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana and Environs, where you can hear things that you can't hear anywhere else. We know that's why you tune in and that's why you support. Thank you. My name's Paul Muth, News from Neptune, the radio edit, I like to call it. Got more than an hour programming here. I guess I'll leave off the personal anecdotes from Dennis Bernstein. They're very, very poignant. But you can find it at flashpoints.net. I think everything's coming from them. Intercept is back with Spencer Ackerman, Attackerman, on Twitter, and he has a new ForeverWarsSubstack.com blog. I gather there might be a fee for that, but I don't know. He's got a new book out called Reign of Terror, How the War on Terror Disrupted the U.S. and Paved the Way for Trump. That's the rough subtitle. I don't have it in front of me. I have a bit of Dennis Bernstein talking his friend Carl Grossman. Carl Grossman's on the board of spaceforpeace.org. We haven't done anything about the new Star Wars, the new Guardians, the space Guardians. I gather there's a science fiction reference there. I don't know what that's all about. But we'll get to a portion of that. It's about from about a week ago, but it's unreported and can't obviously be anachronistic. He's got some really interesting stories to tell. One of the most chilling with me was that after the Challenger blew up, the next space shuttle had been planned on lofting a plutonium-powered satellite. So if it had blown up over Texas like Challenger did, who knows where the plutonium would have gone. All right, Amy Goodman with a commentary about the ruling in Colorado, about the violinist. I'm forgetting his name, Elijah. And Mumia Abu-Jamal has a memory of Glenn Ford, who'd passed. He's one of the founders of Black Agenda Reports. And when I first started, well, not very beginning, but in the early days, commentary at the beginning of the show was from Glenn Ford. He stopped doing the short pieces, though. At least it seemed that way. So Mumia's got a two-minute memoriam for Glenn Ford, well worth your attention. And then Amy Goodman, we'll go right into that, we'll try to make up some time here. Of course, I'd like to fulminate about 20 issues. Amy Goodman had somebody on that made one of the connections that I haven't heard made. She didn't do it very explicitly, but this bounty for turning in people who are performing abortions in Texas and not making it a state action is very similar to the bill that they passed enjoining individuals with no credentials at the voting system to challenge voting, voter intimidation. Now, there's no payment for it that you could sue for, but there's a well-funded group whose name escapes me that I learned from Greg Palast. Greg Palast is going to be on, but he won't be doing election theft report. I'm sure he'll come back with that at some point. But he investigated Louisiana. He's kind of a zealot character. He worked for the city of Louisiana and made recommendations about what they should do for their power system that weren't taken.
Glenn Ford, black griot and journalist remembered. For readers and listeners across America and around the world, the name Glenn Ford was not a strange one. For they read and heard the voice of a man who felt the heartbeats and sensed their rage. Perhaps best known as co-founding the influential Black Agenda Report, Ford began his journey to journalism when he was hired at a black radio station in Georgia, owned by the great musician and entrepreneur James Brown. Most workers at such stations not only are paid poorly, but must work doing a variety of jobs. Ford doubled me over in gut-clenching laughter when he told me that he came to work one day only to find the sales and advertising staff cutting grass. Why were they cutting the grass? Because Mr. Brown had told them to do so. Mr. Brown also suggested that Ford use the name Ford on the air instead of his birth name, Rutherford, because Ford was easier for listeners to remember. Glenn Ford was a journalist who wrote his copy with fire and passion. He loved black people. He was a fierce and independent anti-imperialist, and he lashed the black political class who failed to protect and fight for black life. He joined the Black Panther Party in his youth and became a socialist in his adult years. He saw 71 springtimes before returning to his ancestors. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
The police killing of Elijah McClain and his mother's pursuit of justice. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Please, I can't breathe. Please.
I can't breathe in the boat.
These words were recorded by the body cameras of Aurora, Colorado police as they assaulted a slight 23-year-old African-American man who was on the short walk home from his corner store after buying iced tea. It was 10:43 p.m. on August 24, 2019. Aurora dispatchers had received a 911 call, quote, describing a suspicious black male wearing a ski mask, acting weird, unquote. An officer approached McClain saying, stop, I have a right to stop you since you're being suspicious, he said.
Stop, I have a right to stop you because you're being suspicious.
Within 10 seconds, officers tackle Elijah to the ground. My name is Elijah McClain. I'm an introvert and I'm different, he was sobbing. I'm just different, that's all, he said.
My name's Elijah McClain.
Yeah, bro, I'm gonna use karate.
That's what I was doing. I was just going home. I'm an introvert and I'm different.
Elijah continued, why were you attacking me? I don't do guns. I don't even kill flies. I don't eat meat. I'm a vegetarian. I don't judge people for anything. I respect all life, he said.
Why were you attacking me? I don't lose all guns. I don't even kill flies. I don't eat meat.
The violent arrests continued with two successive carotid chokeholds and an armbar hammerlock that caused pain and injury to Elijah's shoulder. Emergency medical technicians arrived, and after misdiagnosing McClain with excited delirium, injected him with a massive overdose of the sedative ketamine. Elijah cried out, I can't sense myself. Ow, ah, ow, stop, please. I'm trying. Please help me.
Ow. I can't sense myself. Ow.
Please. And actually,
well, stop fighting us.
I'm trying. Put him out. They were able to get the handcuffs. We're still struggling with them. We have fire on scene. And that's where we're at.
Those words were the last ever uttered by Elijah McClain. Within 18 minutes of being targeted and tackled by police, Elijah McClain, the young massage therapist and talented violinist, handcuffed and brutalized, aspirating his own vomit, suffered a cardiac arrest. After a delayed resuscitation that left him brain dead, Elijah spent several days in the hospital unconscious on life support. He died August 30th, 2019. Just over 2 years later, long after officials in Aurora pronounced no wrongdoing by the police and paramedics, a grand jury convened by now Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser handed down a 32-count indictment. Three police officers, Randy Redema, Nathan Woodyard, and Jason Rosenblatt, and two paramedics, Jeremy Cooper and Peter Kachuniak, were charged Wednesday with manslaughter, negligent homicide, and related assaults. Rosenblatt was fired last year for replying, ha-ha, to a photo of other Aurora officers mockingly reenacting the chokehold used on Elijah McClain. The other four were suspended without pay after the charges were announced this week.
I'm thankful. I'm grateful that they saw what I saw.
That's Shanine McClain, Elijah's mother, speaking to a Denver reporter.
Never should have been stopped, that he never should have been brutalized, he never should have been handcuffed, and he never should have been given ketamine.
The police killing of Elijah McClain gained national attention during the mass protests that erupted after George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police Memorial Day 2020, 9 months after Elijah's death. Mass marches shut down highways in Aurora, where protesters were rammed by a car and shot at. In one of the most moving images to emerge from the global protests during the summer of 2020, a violin vigil was held outside the Aurora Municipal Center honoring Elijah McClain's memory with classical music. Elijah loved music and played violin for stray cats at a local animal shelter. Aurora riot police attacked the vigil. The McClain family's commitment to justice for Elijah, propelled by the sustained mass protests, created the environment that led Colorado Governor Jared Polis to issue an executive order empowering the state attorney general to investigate. Wednesday's indictment was the result. Over the past two legislative sessions, State Representative Leslie Herod pushed three sweeping police accountability bills, which Governor Polis signed into law.
It was Shanine's voice and her work that led to Colorado passing the largest and most impactful police accountability law in the country.
Herod was speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. These laws, Herod said,
called ketamine a use of force by law enforcement that ensured that we could have special investigations when someone dies at the hand of or at the direction of law enforcement. We banned chokeholds and we ended qualified immunity.
State Representative Herod explained how she learned of Elijah's death during a protest in June 2020 that followed George Floyd's murder.
This, you know, small, quiet woman stepped up from the crowd. I handed her the megaphone and she looked at me and looked at the crowd and said, "Why weren't you here for my son? Why are you here for someone who died states away? But when I called you for support, people of Colorado, for support for my son, no one showed up." And it was interesting because, you know, the crowd kind of turned to me and the MC, like, "Do you want us to take the microphone back?" And I said, "No, I want to have this conversation." You know, I asked who her son was when she said Elijah McClain. I knew, right, that her voice needed to be centered in this conversation and that people needed to know who Elijah was. And so from that moment on, we worked lockstep to pass police accountability.
It's not just that movements make a difference. They make all the difference. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
That was exhausting. That's the first I heard the excited delirium canard being used to describe what the police said, why they were responding so intensely and using a drug. Following right on that, Amy Goodman had a headline and no interview. There's been so much going on about a new report by the SUNY. It's a state university. I thought it was City University. Creating Law Enforcement Accountability Clinic did a report in conjunction with Black Movement for Black Lives. That's M4, the number four, BL, searchable under that. We're going to go right to that. The title of the report is called Struggle for Power. It was a struggle for me to read some of it in that it had terms of legal origin, like inchoate charges. Here's Sonali Kant, our interview with Ashley Woodard Henderson, who is with M4BL, talking about this report. And
this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A new report by the Movement for Black Lives, together with its partner legal organization, the Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility Clinic at SUNY, finds that the federal government targeted activists involved in the summer 2020 national uprisings. According to the report, which is called Struggle for Power, the federal government deliberately targeted supporters of the Movement to Defend Black Lives during the summer of 2020 uprisings in order to disrupt and discourage Black organizing. My guest is Ashley Woodard Henderson, an activist with the Movement for Black Lives and co-executive director of the Highlander Research and Education Center in Tennessee, formerly known as the Highlander Folk School, which served a critical leadership incubator during the Civil Rights Movement and continues to act as a catalyst for social justice leadership and grassroots organizing. Welcome to the program, Ashley.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, how was this report actually based? What was it based on? I understand that you looked at, and the report's authors looked at, hundreds of federal charges and convictions brought against people involved across the country in various ways last summer.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think the origin of this story actually predates even the work that we've done over the last almost decade and the uprisings of last summer. We know in the Black liberation movement in the United States context that the federal government has consistently surveilled and targeted those organizations with massive government overreach and power grabbing, an attempt to scare folks from fighting for social justice and economic justice in this country. And so this report, A Struggle for Power, the Ongoing Persecution of Black Movement by the US government, is just quantitative data to our qualitative stories and experiences. This particular study focused on analyzing 326 criminal cases from August 31st of 2020 to October 25th of 2020, when federal charges were filed against protesters, a majority of whom were in the movement to defend and protect Black life. And so what we found, again, was just proof that the federal government, very specifically William Barr and Donald Trump, were targeting folks that were in the movement to defend Black lives during those political uprisings against police brutality last summer in order to disrupt and discourage the movement from growing. What we found was that 92.6% of the cases could have been charged under the equivalent state or local law, that the federal penalties of 88% of the cases were clearly harsher, and that out of the 326 cases, about 22.1% involved charges with mandatory minimum sentences. It was very intentional targeting of organizations and communities and individuals that were in the movement to defend Black lives last year. And so we see this as egregious. And we believe that there are concrete demands that need to be met to right this wrong that is now in the hands of this contemporary federal government under the Biden administration and under this current Congress, to pass legislation that actually protects dissent, right? That supports the BREATHE Act, divesting from systems of harm and investing in healthy, sustainable, and equitable communities, making sure that we get amnesty for all of the protesters, these protesters who protested for the sake of salvaging the semblances of democracy in this country versus anti-vax protesters that have been out not only putting their lives at risk, but threatening all of us in this moment of public health crisis. And so we believe that it's time to invest in and pass the BREATHE Act to give amnesty to all of the protesters who are being criminally charged in this way, and to ultimately abolish the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
I want to pick up on what you said around federal charges, that there were these equivalents of state charges that could have been pursued, for various supposed offenses. And of course, the federal charges carried more harsh penalties, which means that those federal charges then resulted in harsher sentences, which of course, anybody who's been involved in the criminal justice system, particularly the federal level, knows that follows you for the rest of your life, right?
Right, that's right. Not only does it follow you for the rest of your life, even in the present, right? It destroys community, it rips people away from their families, and it essentially tells all of us that if we fight for the social good, if we fight for bending the moral arc of the universe, that that is the antithesis of being a good American, which is a falsehood, right? And even beyond the idea of citizenship, what it shows is that if you disagree with the federal government about anything, they have the right to destroy your life in the immediate, right? They can charge you with crimes and ultimately potentially convict you of crimes that impact your ability to have fair housing, that impact your ability to be able to get a living wage job that can take care of you and your family, right? It literally rips away your ability to be able to not only survive in this country, but to be able to thrive. And that is absolutely just unconscionable. It's immoral. And quite frankly, it is the antithesis of everything that folks of goodwill in this country believe in. And Donald Trump very clearly made this order. William Barr very clearly executed it. And we're doing everything in our power to fight to have it overturned.
Right. William Barr issued these bizarre directives through the Department of Justice that sounded so deeply politicized, that had very little basis in fact, that, you know, had very partisan overtones. Do we have any racial data for who was charged, arrested, charged, and convicted? We know that those protests in the summer of 2020 were very multiracial, which was, of course, an amazing thing to see. But were people of particular races disproportionately targeted, or do we even know what they were?
Absolutely. And you can see this, all of this data in the report. If you text the word power to 90975, or you go to our website, m4bl.org/power, you can find the report there. I mean, as you well know, and as the audience that consistently shows up and supports this show know, all of these charges disproportionately impacted Black people, right? And again, this quantitative data only goes to further show that this is just a continuation of the COINTELPRO work of the federal government back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, right? That this is just a continuation of the state surveillance and attack and misinformation and anti-Black propaganda that authoritarians and fascist governments use to control what people think. And this is just a contemporary example of that, right? To make the absurdity obvious, another example of propaganda that's misinformation is Donald Trump spreading all these lies about COVID-19, declaring it was going to disappear one day, that it would be a miracle and everything would get better. This is another side of the coin of the continued anti-Black propaganda that is disproportionately impacting communities, whether they be urban or rural, all across this country. And so what we know he did with this propaganda that disproportionately impacted Black communities was deceive people about the intentions and the actions of the organizers and the activists that were involved in our movement. Right. He tried to make it seem like protesting in defense of Black lives was actually a threat to the federal government, when what we saw was actually that it created more spaciousness for democracy. Right. We saw more people showing up to the polls. We saw more people participating in efforts of mutual aid, et cetera, building healthy, sustainable and equitable communities all over the country that not only benefited Black lives, but in relationship and proximity, everyone else was beneficial to the work that happened over the last year in defense of Black lives. What we saw was not even covert, but overt attempts to incite verbal and physical violence against organizers and activists that were protesting in defense of Black lives. And it gave even more justification to the overt surveillance of our communities, domination and punishment of people that were just fighting for democracy. It was an attempt to cast his white supremacist and nationalist values as heroic in a fake fight against what they believe to be far left extremists. And so conversely, what we saw in his response to anti-mask protesters as being very good people and encouraging local leaders to negotiate them, not only did we see the opposite of that in these peaceful protests that we saw all summer and fall last year, what we saw was a direct response to say, we will criminalize and punish you if you participate in these peaceful protests.
I appreciate the
historic legacy of anti-Black propaganda.
Right, and in fact, let's contextualize that, because I really do appreciate how the report Struggle for Power puts this into the historical context. There has been a pattern going back over a century, if not longer, of the federal government in particular targeting any attempts at Black leadership for self-determination, for any assertion of equality, for any application of constitutional protections. We see these disproportionate ways of targeting going back so far. And it seems as though that targeting that took place last year was very much in line with that. I think people might be most familiar with the kinds of things that took place in the 60s and 70s against the civil rights leaders and Black power leaders, where you had an entire government entity created, the COINTELPRO entity by the FBI, to do just that, right? To basically essentially ensure that leaders were framed, that were criminalized, were put behind bars, were hit with spurious charges. I mean, completely going against this notion of freedom and equality that we keep getting sold to in this country.
That's right. I mean, I think what's so egregious about the scandal that is the information that is proven through this report that we did, the Movement for Black Lives built with CLEAR at CUNY, is that I think a lot of folks would believe a status quo narrative that, oh man, that stuff doesn't happen in the US anymore, right? That now we believe in democracy widely, that is the status quo. We believe that everyone has a human right to participate in this practice of democracy in this country. And what this report goes to show is that once again, a few white men with power and access to financial resources can make a decision that can literally destroy the lives of people that are fighting for everyone to be able to express their innate, God-given, born and inception human rights, right? That's what we're seeing. And to your point, this start, like, people know about COINTELPRO. People might even remember the many, many ways that the state, white supremacist organizations and law enforcement worked to end the abolitionist movement even before the 50s and 60s, when black folks, the descendants and folks that had been kidnapped from the shores of Africa, when those folks were fighting to end slavery as an institution in this country, we saw the state law enforcement, right? The very origins of law enforcement were slave catchers, so-called slave catchers, and white supremacist organizations like Ku Klux Klan and citizenship councils and all of that working together in tandem to actually stop the process of building a more just union, right? So this is centuries in the making. And I think to the point, in a 21st century context, I think a lot of people would have said, oh, those black people are just being paranoid. They're being paranoid about surveillance. They're being paranoid about unfair treatment in relationship to incarceration. They're being paranoid about criminalization. And I think what this report goes to show is that we were not lying, right? We were not wrong, that there was an actual attempt led by the president of the United States to stop this movement from growing and being successful, which again, directly impacted and was led by black people, but in proximity to these black people, everybody won, right? So I think what we know for sure is that now is not a time to take off the pressure. Now is a time to put on even more pressure to make sure that we pass policies under this new administration that allow for this to never happen again.
So aside from the BREATHE Act, which I know the Movement for Black Lives helped to write and has been pushing for, what can the Biden administration do in the short term around those people facing charges or maybe even have started serving their sentences whose arrest the report analyzed from last year's movements?
So we say this in the report, and again, you can see it in the policy platforms of the Movement for Black Lives, is Biden could right now, with the swish of a pen, give amnesty to all of the protesters, and he should. He should do that immediately. The second thing that he could do is abolish the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is really just a tool to target and criminalize Black protest movements for justice. It's time. It's time to get rid of it. It does no good for our people. So it's time to divest from that system and that infrastructure and invest it into actual community-led solutions on the ground all across the country that Black folks have been fighting for decades now.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Ashley. We will definitely post a link to the entire report on our website so people can get a hold of it themselves. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Sonali Kahatkar with Ashley hyphenated last name, Woodard Henderson, and BL, the number 4M.org is where the report can be found. Like I said, it's difficult. I need a paralegal to look at it, write an article about it or something. Next up, not an election theft report, and I go to a lot with Flashpoints and Greg Palast, but this is Greg Palast with one of his previous incarnations as a researcher. I think he worked with the UNCTAD. I don't know. I know the U.S. got rid of UNCTAD during the Reagan era. Maybe that predates it. Trade, and they were looking at international patterns of trade, etc., something apparently you can't do. Neoliberalism says that it'll just all take care of itself. And he was looking at private versus public control of utilities, apparently, more generally, and was specifically hired by New Orleans, and they didn't take his advice, and, well, they should have. Opinions are those of the speakers. We'll get to a bit of Carl Grossman, not as much as I'd hoped. But maybe I'll play that tomorrow, but I will be going to Spencer Ackerman, The Reign of Terror. Have to do some profanity editing on that one again. I don't know.
Election-related stuff. But today we're going to turn attention to what's going on in New Orleans and hear a little bit of background on Entergy, which apparently, according to Greg, now has turned hurricanes into a profit center, I guess using bankruptcy as the method of profiting. Greg, you did some pretty good work early on as a principal author of the United Nations Guide to Controlling Utility Corporations, Democracy and Regulation. And that kind of expertise made you the perfect person to look at this Entergy. Tell us a little bit about what you know about the company and what this looks like now. They're saying it's going to be weeks. What are they trying to squeeze the cash out of the government, or?
Yeah, so there's a lot of squeezes going on here. These guys are good. So before I was an investigative reporter, I was an investigator, and I did write the United Nations Guide to Controlling Power Pirates when they get out of control, and I lectured all over the world on these things, and then I was hired around the country as an investigator, including the city of New Orleans, because they had a power company, which is now called Entergy, which is supposed to serve not only New Orleans, but all of Louisiana, some of Mississippi, and elsewhere. And this is back in 1986 when I was hired to investigate these critters, because even then, the lights kept going out in New Orleans, and the rates were soaring through the roof. So I went and investigated, and my official conclusion to the city regulators and state regulators was, look, Entergy is a racketeering enterprise parading as a power company. I went deep into their books. I got to question them under oath. And what I found out, first of all, they were losing money because they were paying incredible, exorbitant rates for wholesale power going into New Orleans from a company called Middle South Utilities. Middle South, guess what, is owned 100% by Entergy. So basically, they were taking their captive customers. And by the way, forget all this crapple about free markets and electricity. You're a captive customer. There's one line going into your house. So they took their captive customers, and they're soaking them for charges from this distant power company, which they in fact own. So it was a nice, you know, three-card Monty operation, shifting the money from one pocket to the next. So that was, now, but the thing is, here's the good news. Well, remember, I was hired by the government. I said, you know, fine, about $150 million, which they paid. I also said, you got to put them out of business and have the government take over. The only ultimate solution to power piracy is socialism. And the city residents voted for it, and then the city council backed off. They were scared of the amazing political power of these operators because, you know, that's where they put their energy and money. Now, but that was 86. It hasn't stopped. And let me fast forward to now. Right now, 1 million of their customers, 1 million are without power. It's been a week already. And you have to understand, systems are required under the law. Under the law, if you go to gregpalace.com, you could see some of this material. Under the law, you have to be able to withstand a Category 3 hurricane. And except in some coastal areas, it didn't reach Category 3. In New Orleans, it was not. It was just a tropical storm. So why is it in the dark? Why is New Orleans, why are a million people without lights? What happened? How basically they broke the law. You can prevent hurricanes. Ask the guys in Bangladesh. Ask the guys in Switzerland, around the world, from knocking out your entire system. They lost 2,000 miles of high voltage line. I've never in my career heard of this. And you can stop it. What you do is it's engineering. You have extra guy wires. You elevate the substations. You underground a lot of the system. But all of that takes money, Dennis. And I have to tell you, after Katrina, the public paid big time through the nose, mainly through their power bills, to harden the system against a hurricane. You know, it's like, come on, Dennis. Are they surprised that the hurricane hit Louisiana? Really? And so what happened? Where were the guy wires on the transmission towers? Where were the elevated systems? And they're supposed to have mobile trucks out there with generators, these big semis, to keep, you know, one of the things when we talk about power, that also means your water. If you don't have power, you don't have water. And you don't have ventilators for people on COVID, and, you know, unless your hospital happens to have a generator. People are dying of heat stroke because of the massive heat. I mean, dying of heat stroke.
Yeah.
And they're telling us it will be a month. This is what you're seeing is a crime scene. It's not an act of nature. It's an act of greed, an act of Entergy Corporation. Now 35 years hunting these guys. And, let me give you one more story, though, about how they've operated. One of the things that shocked people in New Orleans, they had, Entergy said, we want to put a gas-fired plant. You know, we're trying to get rid of fossil plants, but they just put in a gas-fired plant right in the city of New Orleans, which is basically an island that's low sea level. And why would you put a gas-fired plant in the middle of this little city? And they said, well, this will prevent the lights from going out in case there's another big hurricane weather event. Well, the lights are out. So what about this plant? The answer is a con. You can't stop a power outage by shoving more power into lines that are lying on the ground. It's the transmission system which had to be fixed. But you don't make a profit off transmission. You only make it off
to be clear. They back to Katrina. So yeah. The way they handled that was at a certain point they declared bankruptcy.
They didn't.
And
just
then what happened?
Let me clarify that. They pulled a real trick. Their New Orleans subsidiary called New Orleans Public Service NOPSI, that was, which I recommended get out of their hands. But no, the city kept it there. And so when Katrina hit, the lights went out for 1 year, Dennis. For over a year, you didn't have electricity, and that meant no water, no sanitation, and no toilets in New Orleans, the whole city. It took a year to get the lights back on. And why? Because Entergy put its NOPSI, its New Orleans subsidiary, into bankruptcy. And once they went to bankruptcy, they were protected from the lawsuits for their negligence, which was massive. They were protected from having to put up the cost of repairing the system because they went into bankruptcy. In the same time, and by the way, once the lights were on and the city fixed it and the public paid to restore the system, they took back ownership, okay? But what happened when the lights went out? Now, remember, the New Orleans subsidiary is bankrupt. But the holding company, the whole corporation, had a 24% leap in profits right after Katrina. Why? They took the power that was allocated to New Orleans, which since it was in the dark, they couldn't use, the lines were down. So now they had extra power that they generated, and they sold it at a massive, exorbitant price outside the system. So they had this big jump in profits due to the hurricane. So they took all the windfall profits and pocketed it, but then the cost they loaded onto the public through this bankruptcy shim sham. So that's, that's just scratching the surface of these power pirates.
It's just to speculate a little bit with you, Greg. It feels, given the kinds of things they're saying, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it could go on and on. It feels like sort of that they're strong-arming the government. They're trying to embarrass the feds into doing a lot more and picking up a lot more of the responsibility because it certainly doesn't look good on the ground now. And Bush Biden is the easiest to blame.
Yeah, it's basically, we've got you by the bulbs, so it's your money or your lights. And, the U.S., we actually have an agency called the Infrastructure Resiliency Office within Department of Energy. And they say, look, they even told Entergy, you got to underground, put the lines underground. One way to defeat 100-mile-an-hour winds is to don't have the stuff in the air. The other is to harden the system, that means put in more wires, et cetera. What they want to do is they were supposed to have mobile generators, et cetera, on trucks. They want FEMA to pay for that. They want FEMA to bring in the energy and the power. They want FEMA to take care of their costs. They want the federal government. They want to hold the city of New Orleans now hostage, as they've done. I've seen it again and again when I was working for the city and warning the city about their behavior. I see it again and again that they hold the city hostage. They held the city hostage. They said, in case another hurricane, the lights are going to go out unless you let us build this power plant. By the way, you know how they got their power plant, Dennis? They stuffed, there was a hearing, which was packed with all these people screaming for this power plant. Save New Orleans. Give us a power plant. And they testified. It was overwhelming. Turns out, Dennis, every single one of those people was a paid actor. And even the people testifying were reading scripts. These are actors reading scripts. And it's supposed to be sworn testimony before the city council. It was a massive fraud, but they got away with it. They got away with it. I mean, you and I would go to prison. That's
unbelievable. It's perjury, and it's also unbelievable how you've got the corporate media who, you got these people blowing around, in the wind, showing, how strong the wind is, and there's absolutely no investigation in terms of no real big questions about what's happening with this company, with this record.
Yeah, it's an act of God. No, it isn't. The big bad wolf could have blown those energy lines down. 2,000 miles of power line, come on. And so you have these reporters out there, in the wind, and their coats are blowing. Oh, it's really, it's, who could have expected this? What do you mean, who could have expected it? It's Louisiana, it's the Gulf Coast. And in addition, this is also, there are two other co-conspirators, enablers in this game. One is George W. Bush, because after I was working with the City of New Orleans, I told you that they did find the company and said this game of secretly shuffling money to your parent company has got to end. It ended temporarily. But then in 2001, Kenny Boy, George Bush's buddy Ken Lay of Enron, worked with him to deregulate the industry. What that meant is that companies who were, you know, charging ratepayers to harden their systems, to maintain their systems, didn't have to maintain. They could take the money and run. And they were patted on the head to, oh, look how efficient they are. They were able to save $100 million, $200 million, half a billion dollars a year on their maintenance budget. They're very efficient. No, they just simply didn't maintain the systems. And we saw them go down at Katrina, at Ida, again and again. And we saw it not – if you go to my site, you'll see a chart. The number of outages in the United States since deregulation has absolutely zoomed. It's gone up about eightfold. We've literally had this massive technological reverse where we have massive number of blackouts. And I was looking at the outage records between the United States and other countries, and we have about four times per capita the outages of any advanced nation. In fact, we are in, you know, we don't match Vietnam in terms of electricity reliability. We are in the third world, and we're dropping to fourth world very quickly because of the deregulation. That's one. And then you also, there's another player that people are going to be uncomfortable about. How did Entergy get away with all this stuff? And by the way, they became an international behemoth. They took over the London, England electricity system. They're now a $44 billion company. How did that happen? They ended up with massive influence with the Clinton White House. Why? Who are their lawyers? Webster Hubbell, who is chief counsel to the president, to Mr. Clinton, and their lawyer for Middle South named Hillary Rodham. She went under the name Hillary Rodham as their lawyer. So you, between the Clintons and the Bushes, New Orleans keeps getting drowned in the dark.
Wow. It's troubling, Greg. It really is. We're speaking to Greg Palast. By the way, he's written about this in his best-selling book, Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. So if you want to read more about it, you can read more about it there. You can go to gregpalast.com. He's got a piece up now about what we're talking about. And clearly, this is so important. We're about to, it seems like they're going to pass one of those infrastructure bills anyway. And clearly, I mean, if one hopes it's for, yeah, one hopes it's about dealing with these kinds of things so that we don't have another and another and another. You know, like last night, my roof was over my head. This morning, I'm standing on it praying that I'll survive another day. Maybe I can buy a $5 chunk of ice if I'm lucky.
Well, exactly. What I'm very worried about with the infrastructure bills is that it's a big gimme. And there is a huge amount for the transmission system to supposedly make it smart. I'd like to see it not blow over in the wind. But again, I see Entergy sticking their hands in it again. They're, you know, they're close. They've got both parties, you know, one in each pocket. And I'm very concerned that basically they're going to use the public's money that was supposed to upgrade the grid system to allow for changing the flow within the national system so that we can incorporate more renewable energy. But I see Entergy just grabbing it. This is their game. They'll grab it to cover their losses, their costs. You know, they keep the profits. They charge us for their costs. That's been their plan. That's been their operation. And so I'm very concerned that the infrastructure bill will be abused, because, you know, who actually reads it? Who watches these things? I'm very, you know, this is very concerning.
It's troubling.
Don't know what's in it.
It's troubling.
And you know, and I agree that we do need an improved transmission system, and we do have to get up from at least the fourth world up to the third world. And I, you know, we're here in California where we have, you know, Arsons R Us called PG&E. But in the end, I got to tell you, Dennis, there's only one solution. It's socialism. And that's not what, you know, but literally that's what I found. For example, in Northern California, you have massive fires right now. Almost all those fires trace back, and they'll admit it, have gone back to down PG&E lines. In Southern California, in L.A., which is really a true natural fire zone, a high fire zone, a high danger fire zone area, we don't have these fires. So how come it's not in the fire zone? The answer is that we have a publicly owned system, and the politicians have to respond to the public. We also, our rates are a hell of a lot cheaper down here than what you get whacked with at PG&E. So in the end, these are public. It's like having private ownership of sewer systems or water systems. There are a few of those in the U.S. And, and there's a reason why you don't have privateers hold you by the bulbs, which is that you can't blame them. Their job is to make profits. And the way you make profits is that you get around the rules. Whereas if it's government and they go wrong, you can, vote the bastards out of office. They know that they are responsible for the results of they have to keep those lights on. And you even see it in California, where we have just the public systems, when we've had these big fires, stay on, where the PG&E system goes out.
All right, that's the voice of Greg Pallas. Greg, as always, we appreciate the good work and the great information. We thank you for joining us again, and we'll be talking to you soon.
That was a wild ride. Yeah, he wrote with co-authors. I had it right in front of me, and then it went away. Democracy and Regulation, How Public Can Govern Essential Services. He had ILO, not the UNCTAD. I don't have a publication date on that. It's a historic thing. Got out that mid-90s material there. Unsettling for some, he might have said, and he was right, I guess. Okay, a little bit of this, about half of this interview, I guess, with Carl Grossman. Again, he's on the board, I think. He has been of the group that came out of the UK, Space, the number 4peace.org is their website. I'm forgetting their title. They are opposing nuclear energy as well as nuclear weapons in space. But it's unsettling stuff. And like I said, there was a personal anecdote Dennis Bernstein was a writer in the New York area. He's from Brooklyn. He's been in Berkeley for quite a while. He co-wrote a book about the violence in the anti-abortion. I'd never heard of that before. This is one of the personal reflections he does that we're not going to hear. But you can find it at flashpoints.net. But this is pretty good and unsettling stuff. Look to the heavens. Weapons in space. It was lampooned when Trump espoused it, but it's going ahead, and they're called the Guardians, not the Marines.
In space. When it comes to China, they've had a plan. They call it the Pacific Pivot, which is meant to create a national security ring around China from land, air, sea, and they're very clear about space. While China is much clearer, they're much more interested in, say, collaborating with one of their neighbors, Afghanistan, and helping to build highways.
Well, the conflict at this point between the United States and China is one component of it. But if you go back into, and I do in this piece in Covert Action Magazine, you go back to the history. In the 90s, the U.S. was talking about, and it had then not a space force, but a space command, full spectrum dominance. And in fact, there's a link in my piece to Vision for 2020, which was last year, but this was done in the late 90s. And they talk about the U.S. controlling space, and this is their words, not my words, to protect U.S. interests and investment. Then you go back to the 80s, and you have Star Wars and Reagan's attempt to have orbiting battle platforms with laser weapons and particle beams, and to have really the weaponization of space with these battle platforms. And just let me add, they would have been energized with nuclear reactors, as General James Abramson, who was the commander of the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, said, without reactors in orbit, we have to have a long extension cord going down to Earth, bringing up power. And finally, in the 40s, and this actually is the root of the U.S. space program, as hideous as it sounds. In the 40s, after World War II, the United States brought over over 1,000 supposedly former Nazi scientists like Wernher von Braun, who was involved in the Nazi space program, the V-1 and the V-2 rocket. And they, in fact, and I provide a good deal of detail in this piece, they put together what ultimately becomes this this concept of the United States dominating space. And more than that, they provided the knowledge in terms of technology. For example, the Redstone rocket, which was put together at the Redstone Army Arsenal in Alabama, where a lot of these, including von Braun, Nazi scientists, ended up being based under what was called Project Paperclip. Basically, was an imitation. It was a clone of the V-2 rocket, V for Vengeance. It was the first rocket in the U.S. arsenal capable of carrying a nuclear weapon. So, yeah, it goes back decades. It's beyond the China pivot. It goes back to this notion of the United States, this one country, somehow dominating space, disregarding the reality that, you know, this is what I've been told by Chinese and Russian officials. We don't want to do it, but if the United States does it, we'll be up there too, and we'll have brought war, which has been horrible enough on the surface of this planet, up into space, and as I say, turn space into a battleground, into a war zone.
You know, it is so troubling because you can see the same kind of policy when it comes to sort of the biological weapons race, when there are all these implications that it was China, and maybe China in the middle of gain-of-function experiments that unleashed the COVID onto the world. And, you know, we know that the United States has always been on the cutting edge, again, back to the 40s in terms of biological warfare. And it's always about, well, we have to be ready for the enemy. But really, it is about offensive weaponry. And by the way, how expensive is this vision for controlling and dominating space? Can we afford it in this country? We got the cash.
The scheme is the plan is, and I quote here Bruce Gagnon, who was the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Space. And people listening who hear what I'm speaking of and are outraged by it should connect with that global network. The URL is...
We've had Bruce on a bunch of times. We love him. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, so he's terrific. SpaceForPeace.org is the URL. It's the link to the global network. And he cites an editorial in a space trade journal talking about paying for essentially the weaponization of space by cutting into, by digging into, by getting at the entitlement programs, Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, and taking those dollars and putting them into this very, very expensive proposition of weaponizing space.
How expensive? What are we talking about here? How does that affect the budget, the military budget? How would this affect that? What percentage might it be? What can we say about that?
It's just begun in terms of bucks. I mean, again, it was just established, the Space Force, in 2019, but the budget for next year, 2020, is $17.5 billion, with a B. But that's going to go up appreciably, because if you look at you can find a lot of this stuff online. I mean, it's like that line to protect U.S. interests and investments. A lot of these declarations of the United States is going to dominate space, reflected in just Google U.S. Space Force and get into some of their documents. We're really talking about, the United States is really talking about, ultimately, in my view, a military, basing the military on the moon. And when you hear about Mars, again, a military connection. Indeed, in my piece, I quote a number of 2021 documents, including a whole bunch of them, talking about a synergy between NASA, which was created as an ostensibly civilian agency in 1957, and the U.S. military. In fact, one of Trump's last actions was to put together a space directive, which directed this synergy, this combination of NASA and the U.S. military, which in fact has always existed, but Trump kind of made it official.
Hey, and I see now, I guess just for starters, it's over $17 billion just to say hello. And I guess have a little party to get ready. They are extremely serious about this. And will these be the same weapons contractors that got rich, say, on 20 years of war with Afghanistan, and now we see they're going to have to blow up the equipment that they paid billions of dollars to ship there, and what the hell, because the next generation is going to be in space? I mean, it is the waste and the cost in terms of human life and the suffering that this will mean in terms of diverting money, you know, dealing with poverty, the hordes of homelessness, it really is, this is one of those programs, Carl, and it gets under the, no pun intended, but it sort of flies under the radar because everybody's looking at these big things and looking at COVID, but COVID didn't slow these dudes down.
Yeah, well, it's Lockheed Martin and these other, Lockheed Martin is the number one in quotes, defense contractor in the United States, indeed in the world, pushing it, a great engine, sort of, a great engine behind all this, looking for a new market, is these giant aerospace corporations. Also, the nuclear industry. I mentioned the plan of Star Wars to have these orbiting battle platforms providing through nuclear reactors the energy for the laser weapons and the hypervelocity guns and so forth. A very underreported, in fact, this whole area has been underreported, a would-be reality of Star Wars. So the nuclear industry, with nuclear plants thankfully being closed all over the country, the nuclear industry is seeing this as a new market for.
So they're going to, this is the nukes in space. What happens if a few of those blow in space? Do we know?
Just think of a shooting war in space. If ultimately we go back to the architecture of Star Wars, which we're going to have to. I mean, again, Google space weaponry, U.S. Space Force, and you'll read about online. I mean, you read some of my stuff, but other reports of the U.S. Space Force working on directed energy systems and the kind of weaponry in space that was planned for Star Wars, again, which needed then, it'll need now, nuclear power. Imagine a shooting war involving these battle platforms with nuclear reactors on them. Again, China would be up there, Russia would be up there, all these battle platforms firing at each other, radioactive debris and other debris falling down on Earth, some of it not falling down on Earth, some of it just being up there for years. I mean, when the space shuttle used to fly, NASA had to communicate with the military in terms of getting the shuttle up and out and through the debris that existed in those decades. If there's a shooting war in space, there's going to be so much debris that listeners who might be Trekkies, you know, really into exploring space, you're not going to get that chance for millennia, if then, because we'll have littered space above our heads with debris. And again, think of what would be coming. There'd be little Chernobyls, little Fukushimas in the sky falling down upon our heads. I mean, we have to return to the Outer Space Treaty, which was very visionary. Let's not bring war into space. In fact, Eisenstadt said that what he based his work on the Outer Space Treaty on was the Antarctica Treaty, which prohibits weaponry in Antarctica. It was so important, such a landmark treaty, to let's not bring war into space. We have to, in my view, through the Paris Treaty, which again extends the Outer Space Treaty, no weapons in space, not just weapons of mass destruction. We must get the United States to stop. I mean, we don't have Trump anymore. Biden was supposed to be, and he is in certain ways quite different, but on this U.S. Space Force, he is not. We must get the United States to vote yes, yes to the Paris Treaty, yes.
I haven't as yet figured out that acronym. Canada is apparently a major, is pushing for this weapons in space extension, while we're going to spend $18 billion on it next year. Carl Grossman with Flashpoints.net, Derrance Bernstein, like I said, there's some personal anecdotes in there that are really moving. I thought that's from about a week ago. Time for me to take it on out of here. I'll be back with Spencer Ackerman's Reign of Terror tomorrow at 5, and maybe I'll have time to put on some of this global issue of full spectrum dominance from space, the final frontier. And let's see. Here's an underwriting announcement, one of my favorite ones, and it's time for Radio Free Labor. Carry on.
This hour of programming is brought to you by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. Krannert Center for the Performing Arts is offering original virtual programming for spring 2021 while public in-person performances are suspended. WEFT listeners are invited to visit KrannertCenter.com for updates on virtual programming and other news.